Ah, yes, remember those numbers. You're going to need them next hour when we take our phone calls with Ronald Murphy as we talk about the unexplained, the strange, the mystical, all kinds of great stories coming up. Let me give you the names of his books, by the way. You can do a little research on your own. The Pact, P-A-C-K, The Pact, The Unexplained World of Chestnut Ridge, which is a hike through the Laurel Highlands, Global Goblin Universe. Some fascinating stuff. So we'll be back with Mr. Murphy in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Ronald L. Murphy graduated from the University of Pittsburgh, attended graduate school at Pitt and Indiana University of Pennsylvania. He is a professional actor. He's appeared in movies, television, on stage, doing IDBM on him, IMDb, and take a look at some of his work. And he is currently working on Haunted Westmoreland County for History Press. And we're going to talk about some of his work. Great time of the year, Ron, to get you on to talk about these things. Welcome to Coast.
Hey, thank you, sir, for having me. And like you said, this is the best time of the year to talk about this. So this is great.
I love this season. As we go from Halloween to Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, it's the most compact 3 months. But it's almost like it's every month is fun, isn't it?
There's something to look forward to almost every day, especially if you have kids. I happen to have 5 kids.
Congrats.
You can imagine what I look forward to.
I've got 3 and 6 grandchildren, and it is just amazing, the glow in their eyes. I mean, the little ones are getting all excited about Halloween. One's going to be a princess. The other's going to be a pirate. And it's just fun to watch that.
It is. It is. You live your life. You live your childhood all over again through their eyes, so it's fantastic.
Yeah, you really do. As a matter of fact, a couple of weeks ago on Open Lines, we were talking about some of the Halloween items we would get when we went out trick-or-treating, and we had a neighbor across the street who would give us a penny. And, jeez, who wants a penny? I don't know what a penny was worth then when we were kids, but, you know, I want the candy bar, not the penny.
Well, they want the full-size candy bar. You know, we're looking for that ultimate goal of the full-size Snicker bars.
Yeah, now they're little. They're little tiny ones.
Fun size.
How did you get involved in the things you're doing?
Well, actually, sir, that's a great question, and it has to do with this time of the year. I mean, whenever I was a child, my mother would allow me to go out and, you know, explore the season, and it was fantastic. But building off of Halloween, I was a child of the 70s, and in 1977, we had, I guess you would call it, a rash of Bigfoot sightings in my area of western Pennsylvania. And I lived in a very, very small town, and there wasn't much going on in the news or anything relating to my small town. But in 77, there were Bigfoot reports on television, you know, and they mentioned the areas that I knew. So my mother would load my brother and I up in the car, and we would go the backwoods, and we would go investigating ourselves. You know, I was 8 years old. My mother would be driving around looking for Bigfoot. Of course, we never found anything. But this was a fascinating time to be a child who was interested in the paranormal and who had, you know, a parent that would actually allow us to explore that world. And that's what I wrote about in The Unexplained World of the Chestnut Ridge. I was exploring the things as an adult that I was looking for whenever I was a child. but I like you had said, and it was very kind of you to mention everything in my biography there that you've mentioned. But I went to, you know, I went to college, and I started to study literature, and I started to study history, and I was finding out that these same images, these same archetypes were appearing throughout world cultures. And I thought, there might be something to this. And you find me here today talking about this kind of stuff because I'm trying to tie all this together, you know, what it means to be, you know, to be a human, you know, this collective unconscious
right.
that we all kind of share. And it's just a fascinating world to me.
And when you started doing your acting work, and tell me about that. That's fascinating for me.
Well, you know, I came at it, I'm 46 years old, and I've only been doing it. I had a terrible midlife crisis, and it was either buy a sports car or, you know, do something else, because a guy at a certain age, they have to be validated. And I thought, well, you know, let me give this a shot. So I tried out for a community theater in our local town, and I remember doing the play, and after the play was over, I thought, I am never doing this again, because I would be back in the dressing room shaking. And then a gentleman asked if I would try out for one more play, which I did, and I just was hooked on it. You get to be somebody who you usually aren't in real life, and I just find it utterly fascinating. But I'm lucky because outside of Pittsburgh, we have a very thriving independent film culture, and I'm able to work a good bit. It's just a fun time for me.
And what's your favorite movie that you've been in?
Let's see here. Well, I actually did a scene with Will Smith in the new Concussion movie, so I would think that would probably be my most favorite time that I've done. But there's a TV show coming on called The Outsiders, and I was able to do 4 episodes on that. I think that will be coming out in about January or February. I prefer to do the little things. Because you have people that have a hunger for it. Whenever you're on a big film set, it's people are going through the motions. You know, everything is very calculated. You know, you don't see another actor until it's ready for them to come on. You have a lot of guys with camera gear setting up, and it's like I said, it's almost like a scientific equation about what happens when. So I'd much rather do independent film and independent theater, because the people that are there are very hands-on, and they're hungry, and they're eager to work, and they're also eager to teach you. And that's what I'm looking for, because I started out so recently. I'm still learning.
Hollywood is just still getting blasted. The Steve Jobs movie that came out to run a week ago didn't do much at all.
That's right. That's right. Whenever you see this amount of money going into a film, and that Steve Jobs movie, I mean, they're saying that, you know, Kate Winslet should, you know, be nominated for an Academy Award, and you know, the acting is supposed to be superb, and I've not seen it yet. But our culture now seems like you have to appeal to the least common denominator for it to get out there and for it to be successful. And I think your observation is astute, because you're going to see a dumbing down of film culture for the simple reason is nobody's going out there and wanting to spend 2 hours in a movie theater and having to think. They want to see something with explosions, and they want to see, you know, car chases.
Yeah.
And it's a shame. It truly is.
I love, though, what Netflix has done and Amazon, because, you know, you don't have to worry about going to a video store anymore. In the comfort of your own home, you just sit back and order what you want.
And that's what we do. Everybody's talking about cutting the cable cord. And actually, if you can believe it, even with 5 kids, I was able to do that about a year ago. And, you know, you work on all these kind of these internet sites that provide you all the television that you need and all the movies. Because I was sick of paying a couple $100 a month in cable and watching the same thing whenever I could do it on these other sites. But I think that the American way of life has to be rethought about where we're spending our money and how we're spending our money. If I want to watch a great independent British movie, I can sit down and I can watch it on Netflix. I mean, like you said, I can see movies that aren't being shown around my area. A lot of these movies are art house movies, and you're never going to be able to see them until they come out on DVD. But heck, now I can sit back and watch it on Netflix.
It is amazing, and they've got just about anything you need. And you know, depending on the service you want to pick up and pay for. It's great. So I very rarely will go to the big screen. I just saw Martian at the big screen. I may go see the new James Bond flick, but the video on demand at home for me on a big screen is like going to a movie house, except it's convenient for you.
That's absolutely, and I've seen some great movies on there as well too. The Bigfoot movie called Willow Creek. I'm not sure if you've seen this or not.
I haven't seen that one yet, but you're right. It's a good one, I'm told.
And I would never have seen it at a movie theater until I was actually flipping through what was available. And I'll tell you what, if you get a chance, watch it, and I would love to hear what your listeners have to say about it as well, too. I thought it was a very effective, well-done movie, and I was surprised because I wasn't expecting much going into it.
Are you a character actor?
I would think that I would be. Whenever I do theater, I like to do the classics. I love to do Shakespeare. It's one of my all-time favorites. I find that the memorization of the lines in iambic pentameter is much easier than somebody giving you something to go over. But I did one particular play called Night Song, and it was about an elderly gentleman. I had to go through the makeup and everything, who is dealing with his wife that has Alzheimer's, and she doesn't have any lines in the play until the very end. So it is like, you know, a page of monologue at a time before there's any kind of break. I would say, yeah, I would be a character actor, but it's just the love of the classics that I have. I can't begin to tell you how much I would love to sit down and just, you know, do Shakespeare constantly.
Do you know the name? He's an actor, Robert Davi, D-A-V-I.
Yes, how do I know that?
Okay, here's my thing with it. He's a dear friend of ours, dear
okay.
friend of ours. And I have told him, and I'm going to do this little experiment with you on the ear here, Ron. I've told him everyone will recognize your face. And they do. Whenever we go out, hardly anybody will know your name. And I said, it's amazing. So are you by a computer by any chance?
I am, sure.
Okay,
sure.
Just Google search Robert Davi, D-A-V-I, V as in victory, and then hit images. I guarantee you, you'll know his face the minute it pops up. But nobody knows his name. And we laugh about it all the time. All the time.
Yep. He has that quintessential look for anybody. If you wanted to cast anybody as an Italian New Yorker, this is the guy.
That's him.
That's him.
He's in these movies. He's been in some great movies, Expendables. He's done it all. Just a super guy. So now this evolution for you, I don't want to say it's quite paranormal, but it is. Supernatural. You made this transition into this area, writing the books that you've written. That fascinates me.
It actually fascinated me, too. I've always been a writer ever since I've been in college. But I was, you know, I dealt a lot with poetry. I dealt a lot with what I would deem, you know, true to life. I never really considered writing on the paranormal from a scientific aspect until I started to think, well, there might be something to this, so let's explore this with some sort of scientific method. And I've always been fascinated with the idea of the collective unconscious. I think that that's one of the great Jungian gifts that we have, that we can talk about, you know, this collective soul of humanity. And I remember, you know, looking at medieval manuscripts whenever I was in graduate school, and there in the corner of the marginalia would be something that would look like a Bigfoot. And I remember my one professor, who was a great professor from Canada, and he said, very tongue in cheek, he said, "And then you can see the Bigfoot up there in the corner." And that's exactly what it looked like. And then I'm starting to look at, you know, these images from around the world of these hairy men, these wild men, archetypal figures. And I thought, well, why do these cultures from, you know, the Orient, from Africa, from even the South Pacific, why are we having these same type of images? So I started to explore deeper and deeper, and I found out that, you know, I think there's something about what we are as a human being, to have these kind of these images and these figures out there. And I can imagine our ancestors, you know, telling tales mm-hmm. around a fire, and that glow of the fire, that's our safety. And, you know, the things that go bump out bump in the dark, those things could kill you. But we're still haunted in the forests of our mind, even to this day, by what our ancestors had to go through. And then I started to explore the whole notion of what it means to be fairy, to for the world of the fae.
Yeah.
And I'm finding, yeah, these images are cropping up all over the place. And I thought, if you needed to have one blanket statement about all the things that's going on in the paranormal world, whether they be UFOs, whether they be Bigfoot, you know, you can say they belong to a goblin universe. And unfortunately, I didn't coin that term. But there's this underwriting world, whether you call it another dimension, the other world, I guess you would call it, that is every now and then bleeds into our world for whatever reason. And that is what I've been focusing on my work for the past 5 years.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of these experiences, because you deal a lot with the fairies, UFO experiences, Bigfoot, cryptids. What would you say, Ron, would be your favorite area?
Let's see. I'm very intrigued by the idea of the dog man now. In my area of Pennsylvania, that is starting to become something that's being cited a little bit more and more. But, you know, whenever you think of the dog man, you classically think of, you know, the Great Lakes area, you know, Wisconsin, the Beast
right.
of Bray Road and all that kind of stuff. But there's a lot of people now describing, you know, eyewitnessing having some sort of incident with the dogman creature. And because it is so new in my area, I really want to get my finger on the pulse of what's going on and why it's going on. And looking at some of the old maps from the area, because I like to look at this from a historical point of view as well, I'm finding that there's some areas that these sightings are occurring, and they traditionally have had names like Pack Hill, which I find utterly fascinating for what reason why it was called Pack Hill. And there's been sightings in that area. And I'm also fascinated by the idea of transformation, whether this is a physical transformation, whether this is a creature, you know, that is walking around in the woods, you know, something natural, or if this is a transformation that's in the mind of the person that's witnessing it, if somehow these entities can manipulate what a person sees.
So let's talk about some of these entities. Most of them that I've seen with your work, they're not hurting people. Is that pretty accurate?
That is very, very accurate. And I've never had a case that I've talked to an eyewitness that they were threatened in any way. I like to take my wife with me whenever I go on an investigation, because I think that women have this, they're not intimidating whenever you're out in the woods. And I think that if there's going to be something that happens, having a woman there with this type of essence, aura, whatever you would want to call it, is very inviting to these, whatever's out there. And I remember my wife sensing that there was something in the woods, this one particular expedition, and she said that she could see, you know, something black moving in the corner of her eye. You know, there was something going on in the periphery, and getting that feeling that we were being watched, we were being followed. And I remember...
Hold on for a second, Ron. We're already at the break. Fast segment with you. My gosh, we're going to come back and talk more with Ron Murphy. Make sure you get up to his website, part of coasttocoastam.com. Welcome back. Ron Murphy with us. We'll open up the phone lines next hour and talk about some of these great paranormal episodes. Explain, if you could, or kind of describe Dogman for us, Ron.
Okay, and that's great, because a lot of people describe it as a werewolf-like being. Now, I've never come across anybody that has witnessed the actual transformation, but whenever it was first witnessed, like I said, we were talking about the Great Lakes area of, it was first in Wisconsin. Whenever it was first witnessed, it was spoken by some lumberjacks seeing what appeared to be a man walking through the woods with the head of a dog. And then probably about 40 years later in the early 1930s, there was a man outside I believe this was in Wisconsin as well, and he was attacked by what he described as a pack of wolves. Two of them walked on two legs which was, you know, a very interesting thing.
Sure is.
But in where I'm investigating right now, I've had reports of these creatures roaming around in, I guess, what you would call packs, a group of three or four. And I've you know, had people tell me about seeing them going through dumpsters, walking down the streets of small towns under streetlights whenever the lights go down.
Mm-hmm.
These are fascinating encounters that people are describing here. And to get right to the very heart of what's going on, I look at, Native American lore, and we do have this idea of shape-shifting going on, and the different cultures like the Navajo having these notions of the transformation of a man into an animal, and an animal into a man. But, this is one of those areas that I am so... taken by. Whenever we look at the idea of a transformation, we do see in cave paintings, one in particular, there's a cave painting called The Sorcerer, which seems to represent a man transforming into an animal or some sort of animal man hybrid. So we're going back to the very beginning of human representation of what is out there, and we come across the image of this fantastical image of a man-human hybrid of some kind.
Are these myths, Ron, or do you think there's really a basis of reality here?
I think that that's why, we have people out there in the woods almost every day. I tend to think that there is, every legend has some sort of kernel of truth to it. From an anthropological understanding, I've heard of an account of a young boy who went out with his grandfather. They were American Indians, and they went out into the woods, and the grandfather said, "I have something to show you." And the young boy said that his grandfather transformed into a wolf right in front of him. But the young boy, who is an adult now, but the young boy, whenever he was looking back on it, he said he didn't know if the transformation was actually physical or somehow it was psychically implanted within the boy's mind. And whenever I hear stories like this, this is why the idea of the realm of the fairy is so essential to understand some of these transformations that are going on, because we have in the realm of the fairy the term of glamour, which we still use now, but this ability to take on the shape of something else. And it, like I said, it might not be a physical transformation, but somehow the witness is able to see these entities in the way the entity wants them to be seen. If that makes any sense.
Yeah. When you wrote the book, The Pack, mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
Well, I like to tell people that this is a novel. It is a work of fiction. But
it's got a lot of fact in it, though.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Everything in it is factual, except for maybe some of the werewolf parts. It is an allegory, but the idea of somebody in modern life wanting to transform. I mean, we see it every day. People are going for cosmetic surgeries. People are wanting to pretend that they're something that they're not for some sort of social status. And I just took it to the next extension, that somebody so wanted to transform their lives that it became a physical transformation into something that they had, no desire to become whatsoever, something very animalistic, transforming into a werewolf. But it comes from my research into the world of the Dog Man, and I did try to bring in as much psychological components as I possibly could to make it readily available to anybody picking up the book and reading it. But yeah, I mean, this whole notion of wanting to be something that you're not, this inundates the 21st century. People want to have the better cars, people want to have the best jobs, the best kids, and people are willing to do anything to achieve this type of status. So, to become a werewolf, to do something that drastic, to lose your humanity, is the allegory that I wanted to get across in the pack, and I hope people actually get a chance to read it. I try to write it as cinematically as possible, and it is one of my favorite pieces that I've ever written, so I thank you for bringing that up.
Could the Dog Man be an extraterrestrial being?
My idea of extraterrestrial, as I am starting to really get into my research, is something that is not from another world, but we're looking at something that is an interdimensional traveler. See, that's what I'm starting to go with now.
You're not alone. You're not alone in that thought, Ron.
In the world of Bigfoot research, you have two camps as well, too. You have somebody saying that this is a flesh and blood animal. It can't be anything else. And then you have another camp that states that this is an interdimensional creature. My contention is it can be both. There's no reason why a flesh and blood creature from another dimension cannot, every now and then, through a portal or some sort of bleed over into this reality, show up here, still leave tracks, still be able to go to the bathroom here and leave any kind of sample over here, and then go back into its realm. So whenever we're talking about something being interdimensional, we're not talking that it's some sort of incorporeal spirit. We're talking about something that's very possible, a flesh and blood animal. It's just not from this realm, and every now and then it manifests itself over in here, whether, like I said, it goes through a portal or some sort of way to transmigrate to this area. Whenever I look at some of the great occurrences of what they would call fairy abductions, whenever I think of Robert Kirk in Aberfoyle, Scotland, right out of Stirling, Scotland. And this was in the late 1600s. He described walking through the woods and coming upon a mound, and in that mound was a door, and out of that door was a great bright light. And he was drawn to the door, and he went in, and he describes entering the fairy realm. And in that fairy realm were these very beautiful, human-looking individuals, which would nowadays we would call these Nordic characters. And also in the same exact room were these small little gremlin-type creatures, which in all the world sounds like a gray experience. But he saw them as denizens of the fairy world. And I'm starting to think that the reason we are starting to think that extraterrestrials are from another planet, and they fly around in spaceships, is because we are projecting our culture onto them. We don't see them as something living out in the woods. We don't see them as living from in the ground, that they come out of mounds to take people. We see them as coming out of spaceships, and I'm thinking that we might be projecting our idea of science onto this blank canvas, and then these creatures can basically be whatever you want them to be. But from the very beginning, when we're talking about people being abducted by the other world, it's a very natural occurrence. And even Whitley Strieber had said that his occurrences seem to have some sort of natural element too. He describes the spaceships, smelling like cinnamon and also having a very earthy smell. And I'm starting to think that, it's very possible that a lot of people are claiming alien abductions, and it's no more than an encounter with fairies that people have been describing for 1,000 years.
What are leprechauns? Where do they fit into this?
Also, part of this goblin universe. This is an Irish, particularly Irish character. It does have some sort of connection with the human race, and that's not out of the ordinary. Whenever we think of the brownie, for instance, this is a house fairy. This is something that has been known to interact with people. Also, a kobold, a KOBOLD, it has been known to live in people's houses and very rarely is seen, but it makes a lot of knocking noises and a lot of disruption within the family. And looking in the world of ghosts, you know, this sounds all the world like an experience that one would have with a poltergeist, you know, this noisy
That's right.
ghost. Yeah, so, you know, whenever you get into the goblin realm, whenever you get into the world of the fairy, this goes from extraterrestrials, this goes from, you know, ghosts and dogman, or even the Thunderbird. There's the tale of the Pooka from Ireland, in Wexford, Ireland in particular, that's able to transform itself into a huge bird. So whenever people
yeah.
talk about seeing Thunderbirds, you know, nobody's really capturing these things on camera. They're not being picked up on radar, but people are still witnessing them. And it's very interesting to think that maybe this is a projection of this particular, you know, entity of the fairy world that is enabling people to see them in whichever manner they're, whatever glamour they happen to be emitting at the time.
Well, in this advent of cell phones and smartphones, Ron, everybody's got a camera now. Why can't we get images of these things?
Exactly. And that's the other thing. It's like we talk about, you know, a blob squatch. You know, that's one of these terms. You know, there are these images that are always kind of fuzzy, always kind of out of focus whenever there is an image. And it might be the makeup of these creatures. It's very possible that it's some sort of, you know, energy that they're putting off. And, and I always like to get back to the idea of a black canvas, because my background in theater, I like to think about the way, you know, you stage a particular play. And Descartes had a great notion of something called the of the mind. It was the idea that, you know, you can project an image onto a mind, and the mind kind of puts the reality together within your own head. And I like the idea that these creatures are the directors and we are the audience, and they're basically putting in your mind what they want you to see.
It's fascinating, though, what has been going on since really the beginning of time, because some of these goblins aren't all nice, are they?
No, they're not. And there's basically two realms of the fairy world. A medieval term that you have is seelie court and unseelie court, because you, of course, we have to project our world onto theirs to make it understandable. But the seelie court, this was the court of the blessed. These were helpful spirits. These were helpful creatures. And then you have the unseelie court, and these are the unblessed, the damned, the dark ones, who will do mischief and actually even you know, more harm. And these are interesting things, because there's a dualism inherent in this. There's the good and the bad, but there's also imminent danger if you venture into the realm of the fairy and you don't know what you're doing, because you could end up being killed. A lot of these things, I think, serve as a boogeyman. There's a demarcation between the civilized and the uncivilized, but people are still reporting to this day, you know, being lost in the woods, not being able to find their way out, or, you know, to take it to the extreme, people are going out and never seen from again.
Oh, yeah. We have a guest on who comes on quite often now, Ron. His name's David Politis, and he has written a book and several books of people disappearing in state parks.
Yes,
and
exactly.
In bizarre cases, too, because in one case, a little boy disappeared, and then months later, they found his clothes neatly tucked on the top of a mountain ridge and his shoes right by there in a nice, orderly fashion, and they were pristine. If you were going to be out in the wild for 3 months, they wouldn't look pristine, would they?
Oh, no, no. And I've heard stories like this. I actually did research whenever I was in college up in the Highlands of Scotland, and I was looking into the idea of the gray man over there. This is kind of like a shadowy Bigfoot character that is said to come in with the mist in the Highlands. It's really one of these fascinating characters in the world of the cryptids that I had to get my feet on the ground over there and see what was going on. But there's one road into the Highlands, and I remember whenever I parked my car to go on my expedition, seeing plastered on trees everywhere were these missing person signs. The last we've heard of this person is that they came up here, and they give the telephone number. But yeah, so something is going on. People are missing all the time. You had asked me earlier if I've ever had any reports of anybody being attacked by these creatures, and I never have. But in the same token, people that are effectively attacked really don't have a report to give, do they?
What do these entities want? What's the bottom line with them, Ron?
There is a school of thought that thinks that that these two types of fairy creatures, the Seelie Court, the Unseelie Court, are at war with each other, or maybe even a cold war with each other, and sometimes we get in between of what's going on. But I don't think that they want anything. I think that this is these are spirits imbued within nature, and because mankind is the way that it is, we like to go in there and start tearing things up, and I think that this can kind of rouse these spirits. Whenever we talk about hauntings, you see that a lot of people will go into an old house and they say, nothing happened until we started to do some sort of renovation, and then all this strange kind of activity starts. And we're finding this in the fairy world as well, too. You see in Iceland, people will refuse to put a road if they come across what they deem the realm of the elf or the troll, because they believe that these spirits in nature do exist, and you don't want to interfere with their lives in any way. But we in 21st century America don't see it that way. But I'm fascinated by these areas where these sightings of these creatures are coming from, because these are areas that were once clear-cut, and people were living there, and through natural disasters like floods and just the returning of nature, these spirits are coming back, these sightings of Bigfoot are coming back, because the wilderness has returned. And whenever the wilderness returns, the things that were naturally there are coming back again. But I think that they actually don't really want anything from us. It's just whenever we venture into their realm that we are having these incidents. And people build anywhere without any kind of thought. People go venturing anywhere without any kind of thought. And I think that we are just naturally trespassers. And sometimes that's not always for the best.
No, it's not always for the best at all. Well, we're going to come back in a moment, Ron, talk more about your incredible work. We'll take some phone calls, too. Ron's website, by the way, is so long, I can't say it, but it's linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. And several of his books, The Pack and The Unexplained World of Chestnut Ridge. We will be back with your calls.